Welcome to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. The Awakening Shalom Podcast is an opportunity for digital faith formation at Myers Park Baptist Church that accompanies the Awakening Series, a year-long journey of exploration and discernment which invites all people to come learn about the current social justice issues of the day and how they impact our faith. What we are awakening to is shalom, the Hebrew word for the peace and beauty that exists when we are living in right relationship with God, ourselves, other human beings, and all created things. Welcome back to the Awakening Shalom Podcast. This is Ben, and we are diving into actually a new book in the middle of our Awakening the Body series. I'm so excited to be joined by a special guest, Professor Bethany Johnson, to talk about your book. You're Doing It Wrong, subtitled Mothering, Media, and Medical Expertise. What an amazing title. And I've been reading your book, and I'm blown away by so many things in it. And I mean, it's like we also need one of these on fathering, which would be strange as well. But I was just, I mean, so many fascinating pieces of this book. And I want to ask just a lead-in question to start our conversation. If I could summarize your book, I guess I would say, to be a woman is to be a mother, and being a mother is easy, and there's only one way to be a mother, and it's very clear. Listen mostly to your friends on Facebook and Instagram. Sometimes check with your mom and grandma, and old wives' tales are the best. When in doubt, go see a doctor. What do you think?
Dr. Quinlan, he's got it. Dr. Margaret Quinlan from you.
This is your co-author,
My co-author. She would be cracking up to hear that. Yeah, this is what we're wrestling with in the book.
Wait a second. Are you trying to say that that's not correct, what I just...
No, I'm not out here saying don't listen to your mom and grandma.
Well, right. No, that's part of the old wives' tales, collective wisdom. Yeah. Well, so, what if your mom also has an Instagram feed?
So one of the funniest stories that we heard in the book. So we talk about the life cycle of early motherhood, which we say begins in the preconceptive stage, which, surprise, that's a stage now that people are already being pressured with decisions they make for their body. And it goes through early toddlerhood. And we also talk in the book about how the idea of mothers and mothering is problematic because that's not how it looks in a lot of families, and it leaves out men. But in the cis men and trans men,
It leaves out a lot of people. I mean, I have that as a question on here, where like, what now? It define a mother for me. Actually, I was like, was one of my questions.
So I would say a mother is somebody that does reproductive and creative work in the world. And caretaking can be a part of that, but there are people that don't have children in their home and do parenting, mothering, and caretaking work. And it's not seen as valid if you're not raising a child.
So is mothering a verb or a noun? Like, is mother is...
I think it could be either.
Okay.
And, you know, we talk about this in the introduction and the conclusion. Why do those things need to change? But the reason that we focused on mothering and motherhood for people that identify as women is that the medical gaze and the social pressure is very much still directed at people that identify as women or pass as women.
Yeah.
And so when a father or a dad, you know, like picks their kid up from school, they borderline have a parade for the person.
Because it's really hard for the dad.
It's so hard. How do they fit it into their life?
What did they do? Like, yeah, they had to stop going to work or something.
Because moms don't work. So
some moms work.
Like me. But no one is congratulating me for doing basic care. And this is a joke that Maggie and I have, you know, and there's a great meme on the internet. A woman's mother says to her, "It's so nice of your husband to babysit the kids this weekend." And she says, "Yes, he's very excited to continue to be a father." Which helps you kind of understand this differential. And we're not talking about motherhood being related to being a female because we believe that's how it operates. It's because we understand that that's the social construction. And so that's the place where we're wrestling with it. Because if we're still there, the people that aren't included in that dialogue or that narrative don't even exist. And so we can't have them exist at all until we wrestle with that dominant narrative.
Wow. So talk about that's fascinating. Tell me how this book came about. Where did this book come from for you? And
Okay, so this book came from, I met Maggie through my real estate agent when I moved to a new city.
That's an odd place to meet a brilliant scholar.
I know. And halfway through the dinner conversation, Maggie suggested we write an article together. And
okay.
It was sort of a house on fire after that. We had written almost a dozen together in the span of 3 or 4 years. Like, we can't keep up with our ideas at this point. We have three more things in press right now and a book coming out in 2 weeks. Like, we can't.
Yeah.
It's so exciting. But you know, being trained in history, I am not – I don't have training like you do to – write an IRB and do a focus group or research group with people who are alive. that's not really my forte. I've done some oral histories.
There's cadavers you can always...
an interview.
They have a lot to tell you, but they can't say.
Right, exactly.
Can't say anything.
So Maggie and I were on a research trip in New York City, and at the time I was going through an IVF cycle, in vitro fertilization, and I was waiting for a phone call from the person that, I can't remember, the embryologist. And we were waiting to hear about the embryos. The problem is they don't tell you when they're going to call. So that's awkward when you're on a work trip where you can't have your phone on and archives.
They don't text and say, awkward call about your reproductive stuff getting ready to come in.
Are you prepared for good or bad news?
And
right
you
now?
Have to like take the call because you know they're going to not call back for like 4 days if you don't take it right away.
And depending on when they call, if they called me before 9 a.m. and I don't get it, I have to wait until after 9 because there's no direct line back to the embryologist at this particular practice. So they called at 7:38 when I was in the shower.
Okay,
perfect.
Great. Yeah,
so
perfect
thanks.
Time.
Yeah. 7:38, like...
What are they doing at 7:38?
I know, you couldn't, like...
Go back to drinking your coffee.
Right. It's an hour and a half. I can't call you back.
Yeah.
And Maggie at the time was pregnant with her first and showing. And Maggie has always been an incredible supporter and peer. And her empathy is off the charts. Like, she really gets it. And so she told me later, and we wrote about this later, that she was starting to feel Sweeney kick, really, for the first time. And knowing that I was going through all this, she was, like, pulling on these really baggy sweaters and trying to hide that she was pregnant on public transportation because she didn't want people asking her about it because she wasn't sure how that would be for me. And I didn't know she was thinking about this
goodness.
That deeply. But she was doing all of this management that if I had been in a better state at the time, I could have helped relieve her from doing.
Yeah.
But during this call...
Like, you don't have to hide this. I'm
right,
okay.
Right. But she knew I wasn't. Because
right.
I got this call, and you can tell with these calls right away, anyone that's been for fertility treatment, in the first 4 seconds, you hear their tone and you know where it's going. So I get the voicemail, and it says, hi, Bethany.
Oh, yeah.
I really hate making calls like this and having people not pick up. Was the first
Oh,
part.
My God.
Right. So it's like,
so
well,
on your
great.
Message, you're like, why am I calling you back? I know the answer.
Right. And I'm like, oh, you just shamed me for not picking up a phone when I had no...
At 7:30.
No knowledge of when you will call. And you just pick 7:38. And,
right.
You know. And she basically said, you know what? Everything looks like it's probably going to peter out. So I don't think we're going to have, you know, any embryos from this. And that's like, oh, 30 grand down the tubes. Like,
yeah.
you don't get your money back if your embryos don't
right.
become the zygotes that they want them to.
There's no refund. There should be a refund time.
Like, well, some programs will give you, there's some like Attain and programs like that will give you partial. But even partial is like, wow.
Yeah.
And I called Eric at work and was just like in the hotel, you know, hallway crying. I was crying not because necessarily even the news, it was how it was delivered. And then I felt like, I was sort of getting chided for not like telepathically knowing this call was coming. And why are we using phrases like peter out? And then at the end of the voicemail it said, okay, have a good day, bye. Which was like, so the person was just doing their regular sign off, but like very incongruent with the rest of the voicemail.
Right.
Why does this person have no training in how to leave these messages? So I called the office later that day. Maggie was like, do you want to go home? And I was like, no, I want to work. I have no control over this. Mm. All I can do is what we're here to do. And we put in a 12-hour day that day. Mm-hmm. The next morning, I got another call at 7:45. And I just let it go to voicemail because I didn't want to deal with it. Mm-hmm. And I picked up and it said, hi, I have good news. Two of them pulled it together and I froze them this morning. You got a grade, you know, B on these embryos. So you'll have those. So this is really great. This almost never happens. Congratulations. You know, it's such a roller coaster.
Oh, God.
And I was really upset by the way the communication happened. And Maggie said to me, you know, this can't just be happening for you. Let's do a study. And I was like, what do you mean? And she was like, well, we'll apply for an IRB and we'll interview people about practitioner-patient communication during fertility, treatment.
Right.
And
right.
We interviewed 27 people, got 900 pages of transcript, and then did four more studies after that. The infertility topic is just one chapter in this book. Mm-hmm. But as we were going through doing this work together, we came across a lot of sort of what felt like sort of tangential or like parallel issues,
right,
but not necessarily connected.
Well, that's the thing that I think makes the book so intriguing to me is as you go through it, you've got medical history, which is already very fascinating because there have been so many changes throughout. And one thing that seems, you know, accurate at one time is then completely proven false just a few years later. Mm-hmm. You've got, you know, motherhood, which is a very contested area of conversation in all circles, including religious circles. You've got social media. And just the lay experts on social media giving you advice about mothering, fertility, infertility, everything, right? Mm-hmm. So there's like this expert lay kind of dichotomy that you're wrestling through, that you're wading through, that's not always very clear to me. So it's, sometimes it's like, well, let's listen to the experts. Oh, no, they're very wrong. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to the lay folks. Oh, no, they're also very wrong. What do we do with this? Both seem to be giving difficult advice, difficult help. And just the intersections of your own story, Maggie's own story, Dr. Quinlan's story, mothering, social media, history, all of it kind of coming together. I can see why you have so many pages and you can't keep up with your own research, is because there's going to continue to be a lot of this.
Yeah.
I mean, just a lot more as social media continues to expand, as people continue to look for WebMD instead of calling their doctor, and then their doctor says, stop checking WebMD, I'm your doctor, you know, and there's this constant like interplay back and forth between the lay experts, the internet, and just basic information that you can find there, and then the doctors, and then your own life of what you're hearing from your mother, your grandmother, your friends about what you're supposed to be doing, you know, and what do you do with all that, you know?
It's I think sometimes, you know, Maggie and I joke that it's hard to not do me search.
Right.
You know, because you're having these experiences. And part of the reason we started investigating social media is because we ended up there. Mm. And we talk about this. We wrote an article about telenursing and and we have some articles coming out about Instagram and infertility communities on Instagram. So people that disguise their name and set up an account for their IVF cycle and then get social support and make friends all over the country. And they're sharing things with these people that they may not be with their friends and family.
Right.
Because
they're ashamed of what they're talking to their friends
and family. Because their friends and family are really well-meaning but say things like, just relax.
Yeah.
Which helps no one get pregnant ever. And that's not to say that stress doesn't impact treatment outcomes, but it is stress inducing for someone to tell you to stop stressing when you feel stressed. That's not helpful.
Oh my, that part of the infertility chapter
yeah.
was just so intense and powerful, you know? If you could just, I mean, also so paternalistic, right?
So
and patriarchal.
Paternalistic.
It's like, if, you know, your real problem is you're so anxious. If you could just relax and also have sex in this particular position.
Right.
I mean, it's ridiculous.
At this particular time.
Right, right.
At these three particular times.
Right. So, A, relax. B, do it at a very specific time.
Right.
That's not very
no
relaxing,
pressure.
But no pressure,
right,
but
right.
do it at this exact time.
This is so romantic.
But
right
be very relaxed. Be very relaxed. And then do it right now in this very strange position.
Right.
You know? That might not even feel good. So, sorry.
Right.
Tough.
It's but like, make sure you're relaxed
me,
while you're uncomfortable.
Don't be stressed out about it.
And I think the thing that we, the thing that was so surprising to us, and the just relax issue is something that we had always wanted to write an article about, but it felt too big by itself. And this chapter is an intense chapter because we wanted to figure out, why do we tell people this? Why is it still so prevalent? But when do we start telling people this? And we're like, oh, the 1850s. That is how long we've been telling people that can't conceive just to relax.
Oh, boy.
And the thing that was shocking to us is Maggie and I have both, you know, sought out alternative and traditional medical treatments for various things. I think that's very common for Americans now to do a combination of, you know, dietary changes,
right,
working out,
meditation,
yoga, meditation,
yep,
acupuncture, all sorts of things,
right,
alongside of, and there are a lot of doctors that are well versed in some of these alternative methodologies and are looking for ways to do a more integrative practice.
Right.
I think that's a big trend in the last 10 years of American medicine. But what we found was there were alternative practitioners charging people for e-courses on the internet, and there are a lot of Instagram accounts set up to do the same kind of work. And a lot of what they're charging people for is teaching them to just relax. And so it seems like it's framed as if it's a counter narrative to traditional medicine, that it's not so toxic, that it's not so taxing on your system, but it's using the literal language of the 1850s
right,
and 60s.
So the thing that's interesting there is that integrative medicine is real, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
And stress, we know now, has some really bad outcomes for us medically.
Mm-hmm.
Like
mm-hmm.
in our bodies.
Absolutely.
When we carry it, trauma, stress, all of it, we can tell. But what's happening is people are using, if you could just be, you know, if you could be less stressed in general in life, you would have, you know, better outcomes in your health. But what they don't realize is when they're saying, if you could be personally less anxious, they're also saying women are prone
Thank
to anxiety.
You. Yes.
Right?
And hysteria.
And we didn't want to go there. I mean,
well, that's what it was called in the 19th century, right?
Right.
Now with women specifically, it's sort of pegged as anxiety and stress. But if we put this in a different context, which is really helpful for me when I'm thinking about these issues, it suddenly becomes crystal clear how not useful this is. Because I agree that integrative medicine is important. I agree that there are some pretty clear findings on the negative impact of stress. But it's not quantifiable.
Right.
You can't say you have a 37% less chance of conception if you have X amount of stress. Right? We can't. we aren't capable of
right,
doing that.
Right.
But in the 1950s, the way that they talked about helping people get pregnant was to quit their job. There are doctors saying that in 2018 in articles in the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
There are plenty of people that have high stress jobs that get pregnant.
Right, right.
You know, if that was the thing that kept you from getting pregnant,
No one in America would be pregnant.
Right, exactly. And certainly no one that works full time would be able to
right,
get pregnant.
Right.
But the thing that, you know, we sort of were thinking like, wow, this makes it the woman's fault. How convenient
mm-hmm,
for something
mm-hmm.
that's very hard to treat, something that's hard to diagnose, something that a lot of people get, you know, sort of unexplained fertility diagnoses.
Right.
But if it's if the person just hasn't relaxed and you can blame them for that, that leaves alternative and traditional practitioners off the hook when these treatments don't work.
Right. I was thinking about how that plays into when you talk about conception and how what the advice that's given to men is, right? So nobody ever says to the men, like, relax. In fact, they're saying, well, if you want a boy, you need to have sex very aggressively.
Yeah.
That's the opposite of relaxing.
Right.
Right? So the woman's got to be totally relaxed and chill, and the man's got to be super aggressive to get a boy, to get pregnant. They both have these goals, right?
Yeah.
And it's just ridiculous. All the advice is completely competing, right?
Yeah.
All
and
the time.
It still manages to fit so tidily in the gender binary in these traditional gender roles. And when you put something in an alternative practitioner setting, it can feel like it is this counter-narrative. Mm. And sometimes it's just borrowing an older traditional narrative, repackaging it, and doing that. And my concern, right, is who are the people – infertility happens to everyone.
Right.
Who are the people that might not be able to access some of these treatments? Somebody that doesn't have health insurance, somebody that works part-time, somebody that has lower socioeconomic status.
Right.
Right? You know, people of color, immigrants, queer people, trans people. These are people that might, for various other reasons in society, might not have access to some of these treatments.
Right.
So if you can't do a $30,000 treatment, maybe you can do an $800 treatment. Mm. The problem is you haven't had any of the tests to find out if there's something structurally wrong. So when this $800 fertility course fails, the only one that is wrong is you.
Right.
Because in the description of the fertility course, it talks about how to get your mind right, quote unquote.
Oh.
So,
okay. So
you are the failure.
Yeah,
it said literally said get your mind right. So you are the failure if you're not pregnant at the end.
Right.
So
I mean,
you're the one doing it wrong.
And in a lot of cases, I mean, at least 50% of the time, sometimes more in certain, I'm sure in certain studies, it's more the male is the problem in the fertility issue.
Right.
Like in my case, I was part of the problem.
Right.
Right. So I struggle with infertility my whole life. And so, you know, going to these doctors, which is always a humiliating experience. Mm-hmm. And if it's humiliating for me, I can't even imagine what it's like for a woman to go to these things,
right.
You know, and to have the conversation. But every time I would end up with my spouse in conversation with someone else, it would always be assumed that the problem was with her.
100%.
Right. And this ties even back into the biblical narrative, which is if you look back at the stories of infertility, which are all over the Bible, God's promise related to fertility, it's always the barren woman, the infertile woman.
Oh, Sarah.
Yes.
I'm so sorry.
Right.
Yeah.
And never says, well, could it have been, you know, could Abraham have had an issue, right?
Maybe Abraham's had some low sperm count.
Right. That's right. Or maybe there was some other issue that we don't know about, right?
Right.
So there's, and that's just kind of, if it's so biblical, right? When it's biblical, it's kind of part of the water in society, which is why we continue to struggle with trying to figure out how do we talk about this issue in a way that is equitable, right? Just and honest about what's really going on. You know, the part of it is like, if you're uncomfortable talking to a man about his fertility, maybe not talk about fertility at all then.
Yeah.
Because you should be also as uncomfortable talking to a woman about it, right?
Mm-hmm. When are you going to have kids? You know, that question happens a lot. And on our research, we've also found that there are men that refuse to have testing at all. So it is unknown in those couples if there's a male factor issue. So the problem with that is I don't know how you're going to de-stress your way around an unknown male factor fertility issue.
Yeah, that's actually going to cause a lot more anxiety,
which
is like, why won't my husband do this? You know,
it's
forcing an extra level of stress.
There is a male factor issue, a fertile woman would still have to get something like IVF because if she wants to use her partner's sperm, they have to use a procedure called ICSI where they pick a sperm and just fertilize it with that sperm because they can't necessarily assume that that will happen, you know, in a natural intercourse setting, so they do it in a lab.
Right.
So you have a woman going through a really intense fertility treatment who's fertile so that she can have, with a male partner, a child.
Their child, right?
Their child.
Like, biologically, right?
Yeah.
Which is a whole other complicated topic.
Biological versus genetic versus...
It doesn't matter whose sperm is involved. There's a whole complicated conversation there. I just think that when I, you know, talking about where this book came from, I mean, the book is amazing, but the introduction is so incredible.
Thank you.
I wonder if I thought we might could do a little reading from the introduction because it is so, I don't know, so powerful. I kind of want you to read some of it. Do you mind? Would you do a little reading?
Yeah, just point me to it.
Yeah, I mean, let's start right there.
Okay. So we opened with a quote from Teddy Roosevelt, which I think really expresses what we're wrestling with in the book. The woman who is a good wife, a good mother, is entitled to our respect as is no one else. But she is entitled to it only because and so long as she is worthy of it. No pressure.
Yeah.
So we
Teddy
begin.
Roosevelt is just, you know, very progressive for his age. Way ahead of his time.
1905. He was so worried about race suicide. He's the race suicide guy. He was like, there are not enough white people out here having babies, and I have things to say about it.
Yeah, he's like the genetics thing. He's super about whiteness. He's a white supremacist.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. He loved
and President
Stanley
of the
Hall.
United States, not the first.
Yeah, and his wife has some really interesting quotes in some of her letters about non-white people. So we begin with our own story. I'll read a couple of these sentences. The authors of this text, in no particular order, are scholars, mothers, and givers and receivers of unsolicited and solicited expertise. One of us ingested Robitussin to get pregnant. The other had 4 years of infertility treatment. One had gestational diabetes, while the other had a nausea-free pregnancy. One used Pitocin while in labor. Both of us had an epidural. One labored with a doula and midwives, while the other's baby was resuscitated in the first hour because of an incorrect, quote-unquote, breastfeeding position. One had an episiotomy that made intercourse painful, thus infrequent, for over a year, while the other was back to her workout routine 6 weeks postpartum. One took encapsulated placenta, the other covered her legs to avoid seeing the afterbirth. So we go on and on with this, and we mix up the...
It's incredible.
We just mix up the narrative so that you can't necessarily tell who is who. And then the next section we start with, who is the good mother? Mm. Do you think you can break this list into two categories? Are you certain the person that had Pitocin is also the person who drinks Diet Coke? Are you scandalized that while one birthed with a midwife, both had an epidural? Are you horrified that one co-slept for 10 months? Or does the Tylenol bother you more? In short, do you need more specific details or an answer key to the list above before you can judge our narratives? And so we're trying to get to these divides that we see coming out big time on social media. We mostly studied private groups and the dialogues that happened there. But as I said, we also have studied public accounts on Instagram, Twitter, and we used a program called Radian 6. And that pulls from millions and millions of points, and we could use certain search terms to do that. So we did that alongside of some of these content analysis driven pieces that we did. And we interviewed people from around Charlotte. We did that a lot for the postpartum chapter. And the postpartum chapter, I think people really want to talk about PPD, and you and I have talked a little bit about what's been going on with that recently, but we were talking about maternal death. We thought we were going to write, you know, what's the history of PPD and how has that been related to women's construction as hysterical beings? And what we discovered instead is that, you know, America has the highest maternal mortality rate in the industrialized world. It's like 7 times the amount of women that die in Ireland. We have more women dying in the first 6 weeks postpartum in the U.S. than they do in Chile, in Cuba. In countries that I think most Americans would blithely consider more dangerous. It's very dangerous to have a child here, and it's because there's no routine care in the first 6 weeks unless you have had a cesarean section and then they check your, you know, incision site. But if you've had a vaginal birth and you haven't had like a birth at a birth center, if you've birthed at a hospital, which more than 90% of Americans do, you're on your own for the first 6 weeks. You could have a stroke. You could have post-eclampsia. You could have any of those things. And when women show up at the hospital saying something is wrong, I need you to check it out. ProPublica and NPR are doing a lot of investigation around this right now. Most ERs will say, oh, it's just baby blues. And they send these women home and they die.
Baby blues. Yeah, they say that, actually.
Oh, it's just baby blues. And one of the things Maggie and I have talked about a lot is there is baby blues and there's postpartum depression. And I think baby blues is a very white thing, and I will explain why. When you are a white woman, maybe you have education, maybe you have some class status, even if you don't, even if you are a poor white woman. After you have a baby, it might be the first time in your life you have to contend with the reality that no one actually cares about you. People will show up for the next couple of days after. People want to hold your baby. But how you are doing, your embodied experience, and your ability to move through that first 6 months to a year, which is the postpartum period,
people don't really want to hear that you're struggling after 3 or 4 months. Mm. People don't want to hear that you're struggling after 2 weeks. Like, get it together. You have to go back to work at 8 to 12 weeks, you know? Mm-hmm. We don't have postpartum leave. We don't have maternal and paternal leave. Like, it's the worst in the world. And shockingly, we have the highest maternal death rates among the countries that you compare us to. There was a doctor that we quoted in the book who said, you know, it's like candy. And once the candy's out of the wrapper, we just discard the wrapper. Mm. And so...
Well, who benefits from a world where mothers are dying? That's got to be a question. I know that sounds like a big justice question, but usually there's not injustice unless someone else is benefiting. Mm-hmm. So who benefits from a world where women die after...
Well, it's interesting because depending on how the state operates, the state can still benefit from a woman dying because the kid often doesn't die and that child will grow up to be a taxpaying citizen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So the person has still reproduced. And then when they exit, they stop taking resources from the state.
Right. So you exit at, say, like 35, 40, and now we don't have to do Medicare, Social Security. Mm-hmm. So we actually save a lot of money on you.
Yeah. Whereas, and we don't have to divert it to your child for years and years because you died at 30 and not 60.
Right. Right. So unless there's like you've got like a really, really great insurance plan.
Right.
Your family is.
And I don't know how many 30-year-olds have like... You know, like really million, awesome million life insurance
policies,
plans.
Million-dollar term policies at 30.
Right.
They should, probably.
That's a tip.
Yeah. I guess all mothers should go out and get a $1.5 million policy before you give birth.
Yeah. If you don't have the resources, you're doing it wrong. No. So I think that's an interesting point. What surprises me as a historian is we have this long narrative of Republican motherhood. And I don't mean that in a political party. I mean that in a political system sense. We live in a republic. And the idea of Republican motherhood is that you want to raise good citizens who are malleable and will do the wishes of the state. So you would think that in that system, you would want to give as much benefit to mothers with young children as possible to woo them to you so that they will later give you their children to go fight your wars, pay your bills, and to raise the next generation of children to do the same.
And it must be that child rearing, is not nearly as important as actually giving birth to that child and then being alive, because otherwise you would want the Republican mother to raise the Republican child and to be there for the length of the child's life into the teenage years so that the child would benefit from the mother's guidance through those years. But of course, somehow that seems to not be as valuable.
We don't want to do that because we would have to support the mother to do that, potentially monetarily. We would have to allow them to take a break from work, but then come back to that work at some point in the future.
Right.
We would have to put social structures in place that allowed women to be able to, or men or whoever, the caretakers, the child rearers, we would have to set up a system that would allow them to do that and either not be a part of the workforce, which is expensive for the state, or to try and be part of both, meaning that they would need really good support to do that balance. Because right now, everyone's trying to achieve that balance, and they're miserable.
Yeah.
And there aren't actual structural supports for that. We don't have the Canadian system where you have a year off that is paid, and you have a guaranteed job to go back to.
Yeah. I mean, 16 weeks at minimum, right?
There are people that are, you know, I'm a medical historian, so this might strike some people as graphic. There are people still bleeding at 16 weeks from their birth. It's not totally uncommon.
And now being sometimes forced at 8 weeks or for 4 weeks to go back to work.
Or if you work at, you know, Kentucky Fried Chicken or Walmart, you get 0 days and 0 weeks. How long can you stay out before they fire you? We know of women that went back to work 3 or 4 days later.
Yeah.
You're not ready. You're not ready. And it's not because women aren't strong or capable or all these things. It's because you basically just got in a car accident.
Yeah.
And someone else just got in a car accident, your baby. And then they send you home from the hospital so that you, having just survived a car accident, can keep someone alive who was in that same car accident.
Right. That's right.
Have fun.
Yeah, have fun. Well, I just think that it's amazing to hear you say how important leave is to health, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot of times we think about leave as just time off.
Right.
But it's really about survival. I think that's true especially for mothers, but it's also true of all of us, right? Like leave time not working time resting, time taking care of our bodies and our minds, doing other things other than labor, is critical to health and human development. This is what we fought for during industrialization.
Yeah.
We've tried to fight
just
these battles before.
Just 125 years we've been fighting.
We thought children probably shouldn't be there in those factories getting their hands cut off and dying. And we thought that maybe
before
a weekend.
Too young to work.
How does a weekend sound?
Right.
You know, having a couple of days off. And now the weekend is slowly eroding again, right? And the same is true of like leave policies. We're finally getting to a place where we're talking about leave policies again and extending leave policies and getting them longer and trying to wrestle with that question. I mean, to me, it's life or death, right?
And you would never say this to a person with cancer, right? You'd be like, you're really going to take 4 weeks off of work to get cancer treatment?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, come back. I mean, duh.
You know, put a hat on and bring your green juice to work and get back to your life. People aren't out there saying
that. No, they don't do that.
But you can be in a precarious position as well. It's just sort of, well, you're supposed to be a mother and you're supposed to have children and you're supposed to bounce back and you're supposed to have a perfect body again right away and you're not supposed to have, you know, X, Y, Z. And I think feeling that pressure and understanding that no one will really help you, in part because your peers are also not getting this help. It's not that they don't care about you. It's that they're trying to do it with their small children and have no margin. So they certainly have very little
margin
to give you.
Cutthroat out there. We're all trying to survive this.
Right.
You know, and we have no help.
Like, I love you. I care about you. I don't have anything to give you.
Our partners are back at work. We're struggling at home. No one's there for us. All of our friends are also in the same boat.
Right.
The medical professionals are not there for us. Who's
and
there for us?
That's what baby blues is.
Okay. Yeah.
Right? Postpartum depression is when potentially that realization or other chemical imbalances put you in a state where you could potentially be a danger to yourself and your baby.
Right. Right.
And that is different.
That's different. Yeah.
Baby blues, I think you can't avoid in our culture.
Right. Right.
Because you're like, oh, and maybe that's the first time that you've really had to deal with some of these issues.
Right.
Where you really are in the pecking order.
Do people really care?
Yeah.
I thought this and now it's this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I want to keep asking you questions about your book. What is the reconnaissance model? Tell me about this Professor Bethany Johnson original term. That you've created.
The reconnaissance model is what I had to do to maintain my own mental health throughout this research and throughout this, you know, because we spent a lot of time reading stuff on the internet for this research. And it was a lot.
Yeah.
and Maggie and we both had our second children writing this book, which made it sometimes a little too intense. You know, I'm writing about postpartum death at 36 weeks pregnant. And I'm, you know, said to my partner, Eric, I was like, okay, these are the symptoms you need to look for. If my pupils are doing this, they're not going to believe me. You have to tell, you know, and he was like, okay. But he knew, you know, that he was like, all right, well, can you write it down? I'll have it in my pocket, you know. I was like, they didn't believe Serena Williams. She had to crawl to the nursing desk. She had almost died from a blood clot. I need you to have my back. And he was like, okay.
And if they don't believe Serena, they're
never going to believe me. And, you know, so Maggie took Instagram and Facebook off her phone during her third trimester and a lot of her fourth. But the reconnaissance model is get in, get what you need, and get out.
Okay. And get in is social media.
Yeah.
You go in.
So if you go
recon. This is a military term.
Yep. Yeah. View the landscape. And when you're like, nope, I don't need to deal with that right now. So so the PPD stuff, I had to do a little bit of this. There's a new drug that came out. It's $25,000 to $30,000 for one treatment. You have to be inpatient for 60 hours. It's an intravenous, huge hit of progesterone to help you deal with PPD.
Mm-hmm.
And the conversation sort of devolved in the ways that we talk about all throughout this book very, very quickly. You know, people are like, it's just a hormone imbalance. You need to stop eating meat and you need to do hatha yoga and you need to meditate. And for the record, I'm not saying any of those things are bad choices.
No.
And I'm not saying like, let's just give everybody intravenous drugs so they don't have feelings, which is a lot of what was being claimed on these social media conversations. We need to stop tamping down, you know, people having feelings. I'm like, this is not what we're talking about.
This is
about
a life
here.
And death question.
Really talking about people that are in danger. You're not feeling like you're having a little bit of a rough time. Those are not the people that are going to be candidates for this treatment.
Right.
And other people were talking about, well, you're going to separate the babies and mothers. There's no conversation about whether or not the babies may be allowed to come. These are inpatient locations that would be doing this. And I think that's a conversation you would want to have with your doctor. Other people are like, it'll interrupt breastfeeding. You can pump and dump if the baby can't have the drug. And, you know, you can plan. There are things that can be done.
Yeah.
You can use donor breast milk or formula or whatever you need to do
God
for that 60 hours.
God forbid you use formula.
Because you're doing it wrong.
Because you're doing it wrong. You use formula.
And this is the fed is best conversation. What happens with that is, you know, some women can't breastfeed because they need to take drugs that are incompatible with breastfeeding so that they can take good care of their child.
Yeah.
And in my case, I needed to breastfeed to lower my type 2 diabetes risk.
Yeah.
And I needed to do it for my health.
But wait, isn't just like forced breastfeeding, even if it's like killing you, what you need to do for
your
child?
Yeah, I mean, if you want to be a good mother.
Like if you want to be a good mom.
Yeah.
Right? We're building better moms in this world.
Right. But you also need to do it with only 8 weeks off. Have fun pumping in your car, locking your office, and hearing all of your colleagues make jokes about the little refrigerator in your
office. It's amazing how in the debate around abortion, we have all these conversations about the health of the mother as a factor in dealing with what's the decision that we're going to make here. If the health of the mother is in jeopardy, then maybe in those cases, some say, then abortion is okay. Why aren't we talking about the health of the mother in raising the child, right? That's an important question.
Because if you don't have good health in raising a child, it's because you're a bad mother.
Right. Okay.
That's how we framed it.
Yeah.
Because if we frame it that way, it's the same framing as just relax.
Right.
It's an individual failing, not a systemic failing.
Right.
As long as we can keep it individual, we don't have to have systemic change.
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to say, why aren't we supporting black mothers?
Mm-hmm.
No, we're just saying nasty racist things about how many children they had, how they got pregnant, what resources they're using, and we're making them a monolith, and we've judged that one narrative as bad,
right.
And we can do that as racists in a racist society.
Right.
And then they die at four times the rate that white women die after birth, and we're very not concerned by that because they're bad mothers.
Right, and when I think it's even,
quote,
it's so micro, right, too, it's also like the woman who's like, I just absolutely have to best breastfeed my child. It's killing me, but I've got to do it because if I don't do it, I'm not good enough. And my child's brain development is going to be impacted by this. And I'm willing to take
health.
Yeah. And right out of the gate, early on in motherhood, you're already doing this martyr game. That's going to affect your child eventually where you're like, don't you remember what I did for you? You know? And your kid's like, I don't care.
Right.
I'm just trying to live in this world. People are already trying to kill me.
Right.
You know?
Right.
I'm 15.
It's
like
hot
awful.
Out here.
It's ninth grade. Right. It's the worst
it's
year
the
of
worst
our lives.
Year of everyone's life.
Yeah. And you're like, feel grateful for what you did. I don't even want to be here, you know?
And that's where you have these microaggressions between people because the mother was given the whole responsibility for their child's whole future and intergenerational health because we've put it on the person, not the structure.
Right, right. It's
not
just one individual.
It's personal.
Yeah, and yet, and then we blow smoke and give a bunch of BS out there. It takes a village.
Right.
But we don't really mean that.
We don't have a village available to you, but we know that you need one. Good luck.
Yeah, because it's like, it takes a village later. That's
and
something
you know,
we say.
And Mother's Day, we'll bring you waffles and we'll give you a flower.
Oh, boy.
But we're not going to give you leave when your literally leaking body is bruised and battered and you're trying to keep someone alive.
Well, this is where religious communities are rough. I was the first church that I served when I was in seminary. Every Mother's Day, they used to give flowers out to all the mothers. Already, you're shamed if you don't have kids and you can't have children.
You're not getting infertility treatment. That's
then they gave a special prize to the youngest mother, the oldest mother there, who for some reason kept winning the prize every year because she just kept getting older. Anyway, that's not a prize-worthy thing. And then to the woman with the most children.
Yeah.
So, and then it's like, this is violence.
How very
this is
1970s
violence.
Hungary.
Yeah. Oh my it's violence. It's violence
that's
to the
wild.
Woman who got the prize. It's violence to the children. It's violence to everyone. It's awful.
And it is very meta. So mothers, teachers, nurses. These are historically the jobs that have been most lauded and allowed for females to do and the least paid, the least actually supported, and the least with structural and institutional power.
Yeah. Yeah.
We love to say nice things about it.
No, yeah, right. So your book is filled with weird stuff.
Yeah.
It's got so much weird stuff. Like, I have one of these questions on here was like, why does John Legend and Chrissy Teigen's baby matter to me? And why should I care about that?
Yeah. I mean, what Chrissy Teigen does really well is that she's talking about a taboo topic, and as someone with a huge following and someone in the public eye, she could do a lot of great work there. And she's done really well, but she's gotten huge pushback because they genetically tested their embryos during the IVF process, and during that process you find out the sex of the baby. Mm-hmm. But for all the listeners, that doesn't mean you find out the gender of your baby.
Ooh, good reminder, Bethany.
So you might be having a girl,
or the sexuality
of your baby. Or the sexuality, exactly.
Yeah.
So
that's an interesting thought. Like, what does it matter anymore?
I don't think it does, and that's sort of
if you're open and you realize that gender is fluid, sexuality is fluid, it's all on a spectrum, why do you care what the gender of the child is?
That's kind of what we're asking in the preconception chapter. You know, you can use this Shuttles and Billings method, which has been disproven, but if you're trying to have a boy or a girl and you think that's what you're going to get...
Oh, God has such a wonderful sense of humor for you. He'll give you a boy that will later actually identify as a girl.
Right, and say, I was assigned male at birth.
And you're
going to
be like,
oh,
no!
Right, but I did the Shuttles.
I did genetic testing.
Right? I did genetic testing. You're like, well, you know, so it gives you some information, but it's not predictive information, and unless, and even when they say there's a chance for XYZ or this embryo probably, you know, has some genetic patterns that are more complicated and would be more likely to lead to miscarriage than this other embryo. Those are still predictive, right? Yeah. They're not guaranteed, but it helps you make a more informed choice. But it's not a cut and dry, set in stone story either.
Yeah, there's also some Gattaca kind of fears here about like, you know, genetically created people, and then those who can't afford it have to have faith births is what it's called in Gattaca.
There's faith a book births. Called Remaking Eden, and a scholar at Princeton wrote this in 1997 and said by now, you know, you'd be able to sort of genetically design your children. We don't have that capacity.
We're not there yet.
No.
But you could get close to that. You can see it coming on the horizon.
You can
There's
see it
conversation.
Coming.
And the real hard ones to me are like when you start saying, you know, I don't want my child to have Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. I don't want my child to have these sorts of basic, you know, abilities and disabilities. What are we saying about the kind of children we're okay with raising? We're almost like with a backwards way saying we're not okay with Down syndrome children. Like,
so
they're an
error. We talk about this in the pregnancy chapter. What does it look like when all of your pregnancy behavior and everything you do is formulated around having a healthy baby? But healthy means able-bodied.
Right.
It means, you know, thin. It means all of these things that we understand what the right bodies are.
Right.
And that's very much a part of the pregnancy narrative. However, I would also say that there are parents making this choice. Can I support a child that has this issue when I know there is no structural support?
Mm-hmm.
When I know that my insurance will not cover extended care, when I know I live in a school district where I can't get a good IEP.
But you're already framing it right, like as a societal and structural question that they need to ask and not as an individual.
Right.
And see, this is the problem. Most ethics, most morality, most moral systems in American life are individualist in their – so they think what is right for this one person – in the, you know, and they think you think, and then you also, but that's actually very universalist too, because what is right for you is also right for everybody.
Exactly.
Right. Even though you're an individual, what's right for you is right for everybody. Right. Mm-hmm. This sort of universalizing Kantian crap.
And this is what was really frustrating for us about how these narratives break down on social media, because you have people saying, you know, I don't agree with traditional medicine, blah, blah, blah. And they're offering a counter narrative. And we have a lot of critique of traditional medicine in this book and
there's
all
a lot
of our
of that,
writing.
Yeah. Yeah.
So no one gets off the hook here. But when you say, I don't want to do this the traditional way, and then you shame other people for not making the choice that you are making, you are creating the exact same power hierarchy you are trying to evict yourself from in traditional medicine. You just keep replicating this power hierarchy by saying, well, you have to eat this kind of food. Mm-hmm. Or the midwife in the book who said, just shop at Whole Foods.
Right.
You can't.
Again, it's individual morality,
right?
It's not what's the common good? And then how am I embedded in a social network already? And do I have a social network of support or do I not have a social network of support?
Right. Do I have access to these things I'm asking people to do?
Right.
Do they have access to these things?
It's sort of like a, yeah, you're not, we're not asking a contextualized ethical question.
Right.
We're asking an individualist question and we're taking the person out of context. We're plucking them out of their context.
Absolutely.
And making them a universal ideal and saying, okay, as a woman, should you have this baby or not? Or should you do it this way or not? Instead of embedding them in their context and taking the entire context into account and saying, okay, given all these contextual factors, you're married or not married, you're, you have no money, you're poor or not poor, you mm-hmm. are living in this place, you have grandparents locally or not, mm-hmm. You have
you
a church system, you live in a food desert or not, you know, given all that, you should raise this, you should have this child, raise this child in these ways, right? Mm-hmm. Instead, we're plucking them out and saying, it's an abstract ideal. All women should always breastfeed all the time. Formula yep. should be banned, mm-hmm. right? You know, all women should always, you know, feel great immediately after having a kid and go back to work in 2 weeks. You know, all women should, you know, it's like all this all women crap, you
right.
know, which is, it's ethical violence, really. It's
absolutely ethical violence. And I'm not out here saying, you know, formula companies haven't done really unjust things and literally poisoned
sure.
babies in Africa. And I am aware of that. And in the book, we don't say you should do it this way or this way.
Yeah.
We don't pick in any chapter superior ways. That's not our job. That's not our training. And that's not our goal. Our goal is to move the target from the individual to the structures and institutions. Mm-hmm. that put people at this nexus where no matter what they choose, they're doing it wrong.
Yeah. So if I was going to say what your book recommends, this is a little tongue-in-cheek, but
mm-hmm.
it's a doctor with an Instagram account who always deconstructs cultural myths about mothering.
That would be kind of awesome. I would go to that doctor.
Wouldn't that be amazing? It would have to be a female doctor, I think, or at least someone who identifies as
we
female.
We just wrote about a female doctor who I will not name on Instagram that has an infertility practice and talks a lot about eating the right foods to improve the quality of your eggs. And what's been interesting is the way that patients speak back to that in the comments. And they're like, I'm 27. I have a great diet. I work out 5 days a week. I have low cholesterol, low, 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 and my egg quality is poor. So please don't put this on people. Women, if you have low egg quality, there are things that you can do to support your overall health, but please don't take this on.
Yeah. Also, eat ice cream and feel good about yourself.
Right. Do some intuitive eating and
do
don't
some
worry
self-care
about
and just love yourself and worry about having a baby and not worry about, you know, stressing yourself out with. Although, I mean, you should eat right, right? Like,
right.
there's that too.
So
that's where
that
the
balance.
Complexity is, right? Because
mm-hmm.
there's a. It's not that there's the advice is like all bad intentions.
Mm-hmm.
These are people with good intentions that are trying to offer help from a place. There's some other motives going on there, right,
sure.
that we could evaluate. But there's a lot of it is in good intentioned, right?
I mean, there are very few traditional doctors you go to if you say that you're really having trouble with anxious thoughts, suicidal ideation or something like that in the postpartum period, they will take that very seriously.
Mm.
The alternative practitioners will do the same. They will come at it from a different approach, but that is something that is taken seriously. The problem is you will still have hard things after this period in your life, but that kind of care usually ends between 6 months and a year postpartum.
Mm.
And because we have set it up that way, we are not, you know, we keep getting asked to write about like balancing work and family life. And Maggie and I are like, you don't get to balance work and family life from the time that you're considering conceiving. What about people in infertility treatment?
Mm.
They don't have kids and no one cares. They have to go to the doctor 2 or 3 times a week at the end of an IVF cycle.
Right, that's right.
Right. So how do you – the balance question is so – again, it puts the focus on the individual. How will you balance doing it all and being it all? But we're saying the system will not allow you to achieve that balance. The
right.
system has to change.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So who wrote that book, You Can't Have It All? Or keep
oh,
saying,
Anne-Marie Slaughter
yeah.
wrote an Atlantic article, Why Women Still Can't Have It All. And people were so angry with her.
Mm-hmm.
And I read the article a few years after it came out. That wasn't really my research focus at the time. But I read again what she's saying in the article. And what she is saying is structurally, you can't have it all. Yeah. Not that women aren't capable, and not that women... She was just saying in, you know, the feminist revolution of the 60s and 70s, what we got was access to certain seats of power, but we didn't get much in the way of shifting responsibility. Certainly, and we talk about this in the book... You know, in heterosexual households, there's a lot more sharing of tasks and responsibility and childcare than there ever has been, probably since we were in an agrarian society where everyone was kind of doing everything together. So we have a lot more partner involvement, but it's still about 85% women doing childcare and household tasks, even if they have a full-time job.
And I read that article, and I was intrigued by it. I know why people would react to it from a feminist perspective, but I think the thing that was intriguing to me about it is that she was basically saying the structure hasn't changed.
Right.
Individual lives have changed
in
certain situations, but the structure itself, we got these wins. We did not win these areas of the structure. In fact, we were not even really focused on these areas of the structure, because in asserting our sort of oftentimes in asserting our rights and our feminist identity or whatever rights we're asserting, we assert them as individuals and not in communal ways. And what we're fighting against is much bigger.
Not we have to do this differently.
Right. We all have to be in this. Not I'm trying to assert my own individual rights. Do you see what I'm saying? It's just a different way of going about the common good that we haven't really addressed yet because our society is so deeply individualistic.
And I have a partner who's really, really involved and a very, very much a partner in our home. And he can't prevent people at my work from making jokes about how it must be nice to take maternity leave and I'll get so much work done. Like, though that sort of systemic perception of what the postpartum period is like, he can be as helpful as he wants with the dishes.
Right.
That doesn't change the lived reality over here as much as he cares about my experience.
That's right. Even if you were to, for instance, be, like, you know, not married to a man.
Yeah, I was just going to say, and for the record, Ben, I am cis and straight and educated with class privilege and white. This is what my experience is like with all of those
privileges. All the privilege. What is
it like for
someone with even one of those missing, let
even
alone
one.
All of them? Like, like a black trans woman. Right. How would you
if
deal?
If you even get to stay alive.
Right.
Because the murder rate for trans women that are black specifically is so high.
Let alone having a child and the high rate of death. Yeah. Well, as we come to the end, I want to end with two things. One is two questions. One is what is the weirdest thing that is in your book for those who are going
to
read?
Do you want me to tell the puppy story?
If you want. Tell what do you think is the most intriguing and weirdest thing in the book?
I loved being at the Francis Conteway Medical Library at Harvard, and I was in their OB books for Boston Langham doctors that did in-home visits in the postpartum period, and I studied their postpartum care model, and I want to go back and spend, like, 3 weeks there. It was so good. And these were sort of record books written for other doctors. Mm-hmm. So it's very interesting how they talk about patients, and you can see which doctors respected their patients and which doctors were like, this is what Jews do. Literally read that all the time. Mm. It was 1905. Italian people are like this. So of course the baby didn't do well. You know, there was a lot of that. But there are these ways that historians find out a lot about the community because the doctor will list who else is there, who else attended the birth, what they said. And there was one story that I kind of went, what? Because on one side of the record, it gives the very medical, this is what the doctor said in the postpartum. And then you read the story on the case log after. So I would be skimming the medical, you know, bullet list looking for if I wanted to go in deeper with the story.
Mm-hmm.
And I read get rid of puppies in that list on one of these cases.
What?
And I went, okay, I'm going to go read the case log because what even is this? And the doctor said that, you know, an uneventful birth, the baby's healthy, the mom's healthy. He comes back 24 hours later. Actually, no, it was 12 hours after the birth. And he comes in and he says the baby is laying swaddled next to its mother. On the other side of the bed, there is a box with sawdust in it. And he comes in the room and this mother is nursing a puppy. And he was kind of like, what are you doing? And the woman was like, oh, yeah, my neighbor so-and-so heard I was in labor. So she got me puppies to get rid of the extra milk. So wow. Now we know that if you're nursing, when you have extra milk, that's actually makes more milk. So it's counterproductive. Like,
yeah.
But I was like, there was a woman in 1905 Boston who was like, someone's having a baby, off to get the puppies. And the doctor
and
was like,
puppies.
Brought brand new puppies in a box. And the doctor was like, I will help you take off extra milk with this like hand pump. Please do not use dogs.
Oh,
to be
God.
Like, please do not suckle these puppies.
I know that's laughable, but I'm sure there's something in 2017, 2019 that we're doing right now that is equally crazy.
Oh,
and we're
going to
find out in some medical journal we're going to be written up later.
Yeah. I mean, you can imagine 20 years from now, they'll be like, and they used to have these babies watch this weird puppet show with music called Baby Einstein. Can you imagine? You know, like, who knows what it's going to
be? Why would they do that to
these
babies?
Right.
Well, I want to strongly recommend that if you're listening to this podcast, that you take a look at You're Doing It Wrong, Mothering Media and Medical Expertise, and by Bethany Johnson and Margaret Quinlan. I would recommend this for men.
Yes.
To read, to develop a sense of empathy for those wonderful women in your life who are experiencing these many things and you're alongside them and maybe saying stupid stuff. For all women, for non-binary folks. This is an amazing book. It's an incredibly well-researched book and very intriguing as you go through it. You will be entertained as well as you go, as you read it. So where can people get this? When does it come out? Where can they find it?
It's available now. The formal release date is April 19th of 2019, but it is currently available on Amazon.
Yeah.
And you can get it on the Rutgers University Press website.
Yeah.
And we also have a website, Johnson and Quinlan Research, and you can get to links through there, also press about the book and other projects that we've done.
Great. All right, Bethany, last question.
Okay.
What is the one thing you want to say to mothers out there in the blogosphere? And everywhere that has come out of this book, and one thing you just want to say.
One thing. You're not doing it wrong.
That's so good.
That's it. You're not doing
it
wrong.
Feel the grace and love of that, the freedom. Yeah.
It might not look like someone else, but you're not doing it wrong.
Well, we're going to end there. Thanks so much, Bethany.
Thanks for having me.